This is exactly right.
On the 12th season of Tenfold More Wicked, we investigate a series of compelling mysteries from the city of Fall River, Massachusetts, where problems started generations before Lizzie Borden's murders made her a household name. Join me as we cover the misfortunes that have befallen this infamous town for more than 150 years, including the Great Fire of 1843. Season 12 premieres Monday, May 13th on Exactly Right. Follow Tenfold More Wicked on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's get zen.
Yeah, let's get real zen.
Put your hands in prayer position.
And rub them together a little bit. Just make a little bit of friction.
This is ASMR now.
That's right.
And okay. Get ready for...
And...
Throw the dice. This is my favorite murder.
Featuring Georgia Hardstark.
And featuring Karen Kilgariff.
With a sidebar element of Stephen Ray Morris. Right over there on the ground.
There he is.
Where you expect him to be.
And he always is.
I'm cozy.
He's cozy. He's there.
I would never be cozy sitting in the position that Stephen is
in. I've offered him a chair. Can we go ahead and...
It's how he likes it.
Yeah.
He's into yoga. He must be.
Yeah. Well, he's fucking young, and you can sit however you want when you're young. I'm 37. Right. I don't even know what I'm talking. It's like, not that I'm... No, I'm so old.
He's very young.
He's a young man.
All the cartilage in his knees is still there.
Nothing is broken.
Hi.
Hey.
We're back from our amazing leg of the tour down in Texas.
Dude, I knew that would be special. I knew that trip would be a special trip.
It was so good. I mean, they all really are in their own way, and that sounds cheesy, but it really is true.
Yeah.
And these ones were great. They were just so great.
Yeah.
In every way. I mean, why name them?
Right.
But they just were.
Many ways. You know all the ways.
There's so many ways you can just imagine. Somebody did make me, and I'm sorry I don't know your name offhand, but it was the second night in Dallas, and a woman came up and just handed me a very beautiful silver box, and inside she made a box full of moth cookies. Mm-hmm. So it was the box of moths that I fear, but in cookie form, which I don't fear.
Right.
And it, I think it may have... erased my phobia of getting a box of moths in the mail.
It happened, and you were happy about it.
No one got hurt. They were
fine.
Delicious cookies.
Are you scared of getting dead moths in the mail or live moths?
Live. Like opening a box and having moths fly into my face.
Up in your face.
Right.
Like Silence of the Lambs style.
Yes.
And is it the moths also, or is it also the connotation of what would mean for one to take the time to send you a box of moths?
Yeah, how creepy specifically that would be.
Yeah.
Although I'm not exactly sure. Whenever we were talking about that, it just came out of my mouth.
Right.
And
let's have this fucking podcast.
This is called like a journey into the subconscious that we never want to talk about again.
Well, remember that. So we were in Dallas and we met in the lobby of the hotel. And when we were like leaving for the show, and we were both like, did someone knock on your door and hand you a present? And I had been freaked out because I got a knock on the door. I was like, who the fuck is it? It was like
a guy that worked there.
A guy that worked there, which like, you don't want a dude fucking knocking at your door anyways when you're alone out of the shower. And he was like, said someone had given a present, so I opened the door, which I don't know what I was thinking, handed me a gift bag, and was like, and then I was like, okay, someone knows where I'm staying now, and this is creepy and scary, and I don't know who this is.
Yes.
And then it happened to you too.
It happened to me, and this is the part of the brag that I want to tell the most, which is that our rooms were so big and beautiful at that hotel that someone would knock on the door. This happened to me multiple times, and it would take me so long to get to the door that they would either knock again or try to open the door.
No.
Well, but it would be like, say, it would turn down or the maid or something like that. Because I always forget to put that leave me alone thing on the door. I always forget. I always want them
to
leave
really?
Me alone.
Yeah. Vince and I, fucking, this is how compatible we are. The moment we don't close the door to the hotel room before putting the leave me alone on
I gotta
the door.
Adapt to that.
Oh my God.
Because there's nothing worse than when a person comes into your room, they don't want to be there when you're there, and it's like you're being a creep by having not put the sign on the door.
Totally.
So anyway, the guy knocked. I was walking over, knocked again, and I said, who is it? No one answered. Knocked again. I said, who is it? But it was close enough to, I thought maybe it was you joking around, and I didn't have pants on. So then I was like, oh, I'm just going to open the door. It's our funny joke of opening the door with no clothes on.
Right.
But then
this is actually a thing that's happened a couple times. I love surprising with no clothes on. It's my favorite joke.
It's a pretty good one. But I stood behind the door, opened it. It was a dude, and he was like, here's a present for you. He didn't say anything, but here's a present for you. And I kept the door so closed that I basically only could fit my arm out, grabbed the bag, pulled it in, and slammed the door. Didn't say thank you. I didn't say anything. And it was really scary. Well, then, of course, we meet the woman who dropped those things off.
Yeah, she's like, oh, did you guys get my bag that I sent you, the present? And I was terrified, and we were like, how do we look into this? I'm going to yell at the front desk, what's going on? Did she call around Texas looking for the fucking...
Right. Our minds, of course, went in fucking insane, in the way where if other people could hear us, they'd be like, calm down, assholes. Yeah. Like, this is not that big of a deal.
I don't know.
Well, but when the explanation finally came, it was like really embarrassing.
First we saw her and she was just like the sweetest blonde Texan, like angel face. So I'm like, all right, if this is the girl who's going to kill us, it's like, okay.
That's a pretty good way to go.
She's fine. She's sweet. She'll do it nicely. But then she was like, did y'all get my present? I saw Vince in the parking lot of my hotel. And so I sent it up. Like, she just knew that we were staying there. Yeah. Like,
in the most natural, non-evasive, invasive way possible.
Right.
She knew, and this so sent us up some and also it's the thing that everyone we were going crazy for, and everyone in Texas. We learned that there's a gas station called Buc-ee's that's beloved, and Buc-ee's makes a product, Steven, I don't know if you know this already, they make a product called Beaver Nuggets that are essentially
crack cocaine dipped in fucking like maple sugar or some shit.
Yeah, there's a pork rind element, but also kind of like puffed corn cereal,
yeah,
but then maple like coating,
yeah,
and something about it, like it's they like don't cotton look candy. Great.
It's almost got a cotton candy element.
Yes, because it's just like sugar and air. Mm-hmm. But we were eating them like lunatics.
So many of those,
and that's what she sent up. It was like the loveliest gift of like welcome to Texas.
Yeah, we're like fucking, you're gonna kill us.
We're like rappelling down the side of the building to avoid being in the front. It was so crazy, but it's just that thing of like, you know.
Can we do one last on the road story really quickly? Because that's my favorite of this. The chick and her sister.
Yes.
Okay. So after live shows, we do like a meet and greet thing where we meet so many cool people, like listeners, and take photos with them. And a lot of them give us presents like boxes of chocolate, of candy moths, or whatever.
Yeah.
So one girl came and met us, and she was so nice, and she was like, "You guys got me through some really hard times. Thank you so much." Whatever. And we're like, "Great, okay." And then we go to take a photo with her, and as the photo is about to be taken,
there's that moment of silence where we all turn to the camera and are like, "Fake smile, cheers. Do a weird pose." And right in that moment, she goes,
she, like,
"I'm
going to
do what the lady did, and then George is going to do what she did."
Okay.
Okay. So the lady goes, "My sister's dying." And Georgia laughed just like that.
Louder.
Like, Georgia burst out laughing.
I was cracking up. Because when you're in a horrified position, sometimes you just laugh.
Well, and it was so quiet. It was like, I think it was the tension of like, what the fuck are we going to do now? What?
My sister's dying.
So then Georgia laughs. Then the pictures taking is over.
Georgia!
I didn't say it like that.
You were kind of like, don't do that.
Well, I was just like that.
You admonished me in a way you've never admonished me before.
Well, you were laughing because she said her sister was dying.
I didn't say you were in the wrong at all. I 100% agree with you.
So I turn to the woman.
After the photo, we were like, oh my God. Both of us like, are you okay? Like, what are you talking about?
We're like,
tell us everything.
Eye contact, turned, you know, circle up,
this
huddle up.
This is going to be a moment.
This is a thing, and we're here for you. We get it. And then she goes, she is so jealous that she's not here right.
She's
just
dying.
Fucking used the wrong phrasing right in the moment of silence. So it felt like she was basically saying, I'd like to tell you this very sad thing.
My sister is dying.
No.
My sister's dying.
Dying
is how
jealousy.
She meant to say it.
Yeah.
So now we know how I react in moments of fucking horror. And now we know. I don't know.
It was hilarious.
That's about it.
It was super. And also, she thought it was kind of funny. Once we were like, we thought your sister was dying. And then she was like, oh, no, no, she's fine.
We
she's
were like mad at her.
Yeah. Because that was a lot. Okay, tell me. Have a corrections corner.
Okay.
And this really is only for the people that were at our second show in Dallas. Oh. When I did the story of Terry Hoffman, who was this crazy cult leader. It was one of my favorite murder stories I've ever done. But at the end... I said she died in 1997, mm-hmm. which was very odd. I like pulled it out because I didn't have it on the page.
Right.
And I'd forgotten to write. I had some things, notes I wanted to make, and I just didn't do it. So I just wanted to tell everybody she actually died in 2015 at age 77.
That is a big difference in time.
She just kept going.
She was just like not giving up on this cult dream.
No, she wasn't at all. And she that book that she made was The Color of Money, The Power of Color, mm-hmm. Money Force, or the Color of Money, Power Force. It's some bullshit book about, like, and we talked about it that night, whatever color you wear is going to bring you money in different degrees.
No. How about a fucking vintage orange clown blanket? Is that going to bring me a lot? Because that's what I'm wearing right now.
Oh, look, there's a $50 bill stuffed underneath your butt.
Holy shit. Oh, no, that's just where I keep my money.
Oh, just stuffed right under your one cheek?
Mm-hmm.
I have a second corrections corner.
Okay.
This is for everybody. Last week, I said that the director of Wind River was a woman, and it certainly is not a woman.
I don't remember any of this.
I'm not sure exactly where I got it, but it was the movie that I was talking about. I watched it on the plane,
uh-huh.
and it was really good. It was about the murder on Native American land.
Oh, right.
And it was... So I said... It's Taylor. I'm going to look it up really quick. The director's name... is Taylor Sheridan,
mm-hmm.
and that's a man.
Taylor is an interchangeable name.
It
gender
is,
name.
But I feel like I should have at least glanced at a Wikipedia. But I think I thought I remembered a female woman of love, like a Native American female woman getting accolades, and so I kind of really combined it all in my mind. Anyway,
okay.
Props to Taylor Sheridan because it's such a good movie.
Okay, I'll watch it. Can I tell you something?
Yes.
From the internet?
Yes.
Okay, I found an article recently. It says it's from a place. It's a DC 101 is the name of the website, and it says, "Weird news: the voice behind many best-selling books on tape is actually a serial killer."
No.
So it turns out that in the 80s, a blind couple showing their appreciation to the prisoners of the California Medical Facility State Prison who have voiced they started a program to have the inmates there voice audiobooks.
Okay.
The program was then run by our friend Ed Kemper.
No!
So it's called Volunteers of Vacaville or The Blind Project. They recorded thousands of books, bestsellers, textbooks, mysteries, science fiction, westerns, children's books, and cookbooks onto tape cassettes. From 1977 to 87, Kemper had spent over 5,000 hours in the recording booth and had more than 4 million feet of tape and several hundred books to his credit, including, and this is the best one, Flowers in the Fucking Addict.
Yes.
Addict.
Addict.
Shit.
Addict.
God damn it.
Flowers in the Addictions.
Flowers in the Addict. Why do I do that?
Okay. Purely based on Mindhunter, the wonderful series on Netflix that I personally love, mm-hmm. and the way that actor played Ed Kemper.
Oh, can you
imagine Flowers in the Attic as that guy in that kind of nerdy voice like that?
She touched his groin. Is that in the book? I don't know.
They what were if I knew sister and brother touching groins.
My brother liked that. We have to track that down somewhere.
I mean. I would never listen to that in a million years.
I would. What if I started falling asleep to that at night? Because you know it's
Georgia?
Relaxing.
No, it is not.
Calming and relaxing.
No.
It's one of my new fall asleep at night books.
No.
And then I kill a bunch of people. And they're not related at all.
I find, and I've already bragged that I'm sound sensitive, I find people's voices to be a real make or break.
Uh-huh.
And knowing that a person who had that voice...
Oh, right.
...was also a... psychotic killer who beheaded his own mother.
Be a heartbreak for you.
That would be a tough one to separate and not hear all the crickly crags of insanity and murder in there.
Fair enough. So I can listen to a book about murder while falling asleep, but I can't listen to, I shouldn't listen to a book by a murderer, read by a murderer.
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think you need that in your subconscious.
Because you do the thing where, you know, when like you look at old photos of a murderer and you're like, do I see it? Can I see it?
Yes.
I can see it in his eyes.
Right.
Will I hear it in his voice?
You absolutely will.
Of course I will.
Bad dreams.
Yes.
If nothing else, you're to be hearing the voice of a sociopath who has no human, like normal human connection
to the book.
He's just not going to do the book justice. We read so much V.C. Andrews when I was like 12.
Oh my God. Me too.
It should have been taken away from us.
It should have been banned. Listen, I'm not for banning books.
No, not really, but.
But V.C. Andrews had some shit going on.
Do you ever read My Sweet Audrina?
Yes.
Okay, I obsessed on that concept where I was like,
good.
What if my parents have brainwashed me and I don't remember my actual childhood? Like, that whole concept was unbelievable.
Can I tell you how badly I wanted to have been adopted and I wanted to have been kidnapped by my parents and they weren't really my parents?
Yep.
What the fuck is wrong? Why would they?
Because it's just like exciting. Yeah. Like you're just sitting there in front of your TV dinner, you know what I mean? Like having your normal life and you're like, what if something happened?
What if something cool happened?
Yeah.
Like I didn't belong here.
Yeah.
Let's read that again. Let's book club it right now.
Yes.
Do you want to?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Let's all read. Which one do you want to do? Do you want to do My Sweet Audrina?
I don't remember most of My Sweet Audrina, but it gives me chills. So I must know something is going on in that book.
I'm pretty sure that's the one where at one point, the adoptive mother, somebody scrubs somebody else with bleach in a bathtub.
Fun.
Do you remember that?
No.
Like, you must get clean.
You're not clean. No, let's do it.
If it's not that one, it's a different
piece. Let's do that one or Flowers in the Attic. Let's start with, which should we start with?
I kind of want to do My Sweet Audrina just because it's a little bit, like, I just rewatched they did a Flowers in the Attic made for TV movie on Lifetime.
Oh my God.
Did you watch it, Steven? Did Malls do an episode?
No, but she should.
No, yeah, she absolutely should.
Wait, will you tell her I'll do it with her if she does it?
Yes, so yeah.
Oh, Malls, do you want to do it too?
Sure. Yeah. Malls has a podcast called
Mother May I Sleep With Podcast.
Mother May I Sleep With Podcast that we've both done where you watch a fucking made-for-TV Lifetime movie.
Yeah.
And did she stop doing it?
She's seasonal, so because you know, you go beat by beat of the movie, so she does it in 15 episode chunks, takes a few months off.
Okay. Oh, makes
well then
sense.
We all have time to absorb it, watch it 15 times,
like write, you know, full essays on it. Okay, good.
All right, Malls. Molly McAleer,
we're coming at you.
We're coming for you.
But everybody else that wants to do this, let's all read My Sweet Audrina. Like, do you want to go pick up copies tomorrow?
Sure.
Today, it will be...
It has to be a used, like, paperback copy, too. Okay. Let's say that. It has to be a haunted copy.
Yes!
That's haunted with the tears of a fucking girl from the 80s who's like, I hope I get kidnapped.
Yes.
By a hot... Cut that out. I don't know. But fantasies.
If you can go to a thrift store that has the copy of this, or your mother or your grandmother's bookshelf. It makes me think of the cabin we used to stay in Blue Lake that had all kinds of Stephen King, V.C. Andrews. They had all that shit at this cabin. You could just go pick some horrible book you were going to read while you were there for the week.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
So we're all starting Team. My Sweet Audrina this Friday.
Yeah, because so the next week is Thanksgiving. So we're putting a live episode up. And so let's meet back here in a week, in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks at the beginning of December.
Yeah.
Whatever our next apartment episode is.
We'll meet you here.
And we will have read and we will be ready to discuss My Sweet Audrina.
You guys.
This is epic.
Epic. Send us notes. Your thoughts.
Oh.
All right.
Okay. Why am I so excited?
Oh, because it's the best thing we've ever done.
Other things.
Oh, really quickly. We have a couple new tour dates because you guys got really angry about certain things and messaged our fucking tour agent, Joe.
Yes.
February 15th, we added a second show to Salt Lake City at Kingsbury Hall. Those go on sale Friday, November 17th, which I think is tomorrow.
Yeah.
So Salt Lake City, second show.
You got your second show, Salt Lake City. God bless you for demanding it.
You scared our fucking tour agent,
yes,
Joe.
And that's how you have to do it in
that's
this business.
How you do it.
Come at him.
Dublin, is that a second show?
Yeah, but they already put it up for sale. So it's May 7th. It's Vicker Street, and it's already on sale. Yeah. They didn't do any kind of hold. They were like, fine, we're doing it. Yeah. So
Dublin's May 7th second show.
Yep. Yeah. And then May 17th, we added a second show.
This is the first, this is a new show.
Oh, this is new? Sorry, yeah. May 17th, Glasgow, Scotland.
Hey.
We are doing a show for you. And I just would like to say, I lived there.
Right.
In 2002.
Yeah.
I lived within you, Glasgow, for I think 3 months. So come support your homegirl.
Yeah, come say hi again. Hey, remember me?
Yeah, hey, hi. I never understood what a lot of people were saying here, but I really had the best time. So those also go on sale tomorrow. The show is going to be at the, is it the O2 Academy? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, the O2 Academy.
O2 okay. Academy.
Basically, just go to myfavoritemurder.com/live for all the details and all the other shows we're doing that are fucking, we're really excited about. 2018 is going to be rad. We're getting new merch. It's going to be a new, like, a fucking new experience.
It's going to be, we're having the best time on the road.
Oh my God.
You guys are so fun to come and meet and do shows with. It's, we really are. It's quite, it's a peak experience.
Oh, and it's a peak experience. We're reposting our holiday, holiday merch design. So go to myfavoritemurdershirts.com and check out the ugly holiday sweater kind of like spoof that we did on that.
Yeah. It's one of George's earliest concepts. Was it yours or mine?
No. I don't know. Did Kirsten just do it from the Printful?
I can't remember.
I don't know.
I mean, I know Kirsten designed it.
Yeah.
But I can't remember which one of us thought of it.
I won't take credit because I don't remember.
I won't either.
It's basically a really cute looking Christmas design that says, here's the thing, fuck everyone in it. And like, stay sexy, don't get murdered. But it looks like a Christmas sweater. It's great.
So it's also like a sweatshirt. So you don't have to wear you can still have an ugly Christmas sweater without the heat or discomfort of an ugly Christmas sweater.
Right. You get a t-shirt. There's going to be a mug. Listen.
Come on. We're doing it all for you. Look.
We're here for you. Look and listen.
Please.
At myfavoritemurdershorts.com.
.com.
Goodbye.
.org.
.org. You know. .. What's it? Is there like a religious one? .. something?
.GESUS.
GESUS. You just spelled Jesus wrong. Miss Catholic.
That's because I was trying to include everybody. Some people call him God. Some people call him Yahweh. Hold on. GESUS.
Wow. That's, I think my addict has been usurped as the.
I do not mean to complain, but
complain.
Recently I've been in states of mind of being so tired and drained.
Yeah.
Or just like. We just talk
too much
so
information.
Much.
Yeah.
There's so much talking that I hear things come out of my mouth. Or I'm doing that weird thing of like you hold a door open for someone and they walk through and then you're like, you're welcome tomorrow. Or you say just some totally weird thing and you think you're saying the normal thing.
Yeah.
Ugh.
No, I get it.
Horrifying.
It's fun. No, it's not.
It's a good time.
Who's first this week? You know what? We started. Let's talk about this really quickly.
Okay.
We decided that, and I think we should talk more about this, of who should be first this week. Meaning, if your fucking murder is horrifying and awful, and I have a fucking delightful black widower from the fucking 1800s who just like kills all her husbands.
Yep.
It's like, well, I should go second to like bring it back up.
That's right.
Like last week I went second and did the Bernies, and that is just a terrible story, and you should have closed it.
Right. And same with, remember the last night I did the story of the boy that killed his father,
right?
And same exact thing where we're both like, anyway.
And I did a fucking guy who dressed up as Santa Claus in the early 1900s and robbed a bank, and it was hilarity ensued. So much hilarity ensued. And this is Dallas, third night in Dallas.
Was it third night?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
So I should have closed. So,
I mean, look, we can look back in remembrance all we want, but we're
maybe when one of us knows we're doing a murder, our story is fucking horrific, and we can tell the other person like, "Hey, this isn't a closer. Can you do the closer?"
Yes, that sounds fine to me.
Okay, so mine right now, it can be a closer if you need it to be.
Okay,
how's yours?
Not
okay. Oh, okay, my God.
Perfect. So we
Karen's
are,
first.
Right now, we are now officially dismantling the who went first last time.
Unless we need it. Unless it doesn't matter. Unless
but then we, how will we go back to it?
Whenever we decide.
Okay.
We'll make it up on the spot. Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We can do it whatever we want.
Right. There's no format.
This is all pretend. All right.
Okay, well, great.
Hey, Karen, you know that feeling when you're stressed out and your heart starts to pound and your mind is racing?
I do. I know it well.
Well, while there's no cure for stress, therapy can help shape your response to it. And since May is Mental Health Awareness Month, there's no better time to try Talkspace.
When you sign up for Talkspace, you'll receive a personalized match with a therapist or psychologist, typically within 48 hours.
Forbes rates Talkspace as the number one online therapy platform, plus their licensed professionals are in-network with almost all major insurance companies.
Once you meet your therapy goals, or if you want to cancel for any reason, Talkspace will provide you with a prorated refund for unused time. I feel like these days people understand the importance of therapy, but the difficult part is just taking that first step. It took me months to make my first therapy appointment. I was so scared. I had a lot of ideas in my head about it. And that's why I think Talkspace is such a good idea, because making it so approachable will just get you there sooner. Then you can actually get in there, figure out what you need, talk to an actual professional, and be on your way to solving some stuff that you might want
to
solve.
To celebrate Mental Health Awareness Month and the power of talking it out in therapy, Talkspace is offering our listeners $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80.
Go to Talkspace.com/MFM and use promo code SPACE80.
To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/MFM and enter promo code SPACE80 and get $80 off your first month and show your support for our show.
That's Talkspace.com/MFM. Enter promo code SPACE80.
Goodbye.
There's something about the sound of an old-timey cash register that really takes me back.
I know. It sounds like someone is about to hand me an ice cream cone, but it also sounds like we just sold some merch.
That's right. And if you're a Shopify user like us, you know that this sound means you just made a sale.
Shopify has helped millions of businesses sell their products online, but did you know they also offer the same support for brick and mortar stores?
From accepting payments to managing inventory, they have everything you need to sell in person. So give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify.
Shopify POS tracks sales across all your locations. That way, you'll always know what you have in stock and where.
They also provide reliable tech that fits your unique retail needs, like turning a tablet into a credit card reader.
And if you're looking to reach new customers, check out Shopify's marketing tools. They're easy to use, and they integrate with all social media platforms.
With Shopify, we have a powerful partner for managing our sales. And if you're a business owner, you can too.
Do retail right with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period today at shopify.com/murder. And here's the important note, that promo code is all lowercase.
So go to shopify.com/murder and take your retail business to the next level.
That's shopify.com/murder. Again, don't forget, the code is all lowercase.
Goodbye.
This, it's funny because in thinking of that, I worked on a couple different murders, and I did this in Texas a couple times where I'd start something and I'd be like, this is too depressing.
Yes.
So like there was the killing fields. I was working on the killing fields because it's right outside Houston. Mm-hmm. And it is a place where either one or several serial killers go to dump young women's bodies. Mm-hmm. It's been going on for years. No one's ever, I think they caught one guy that's connected to 11 murders, but they haven't caught all of them. It's the bleakest.
There's a show called The 11 right now that you can watch. I think it's an Annie show on demand.
Oh, is that
about
true?
About them. Yeah, it's good.
On Annie?
Well, it's on demand. I don't know who did it.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Yeah.
Because it's very involved and convoluted. And I would say a quarter of the way through it, and then I was like,
can't do this.
This is for a live show especially is just so bleak.
Well, we get so many people at live shows being like, why didn't you do this murder? And it's like, because it's so fucking depressing. Not because we don't want to or didn't know about it.
Right.
It's just like hearing the audience's silence when you're talking about a fucking 11 people getting murdered who didn't, and it's not solved.
Yeah.
Is a huge bummer.
It's rough. Yeah. And also it's Well, whatever. There's okay. just all kinds of elements going on.
This is great.
So it's just felt like I've started and stopped many because there's so many dark ones. But then I stumbled upon an episode of the television show Deadly Devotion, which I think is on ID.
Never seen that one.
I got it on Apple, like iTunes.
Yeah.
But so it's basically like murders that happen within certain churches or religious groups.
Oh,
obviously.
That's fun.
Yeah. So this one is pretty amazing. It's the Amish serial killer.
Amish serial killer?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, not in the classic sense, but yes.
Okay.
So there's a... I knew nothing about any of this. I didn't know there were subsets of Amish within the Amish. Mm-mm. And there are some who are more liberal and some who are more conservative. Mm-hmm. That sounds political, but more, classic, old school. And the Schwarzenruber Truber Amish, I'm sorry, Schwarzentruber Amish are the considered old order Amish. They speak Pennsylvania Germans. I'm not even reading off the page that I'm holding in front of my face. I'm like trying to remember off the top of my head as I'm looking at it. They speak Pennsylvania German. They speak English with outsiders. They don't follow, they don't fellowship or intermarry with more liberal Amish orders. So they won't go outside of their own Amish group. If they consider the Amish who put the red orange reflective signs on the back of their carriages that say like slow thing,
kill me. Yeah,
that's too liberal for them. Okay. These people don't have running water or indoor plumbing. They never ride in cars unless it's an absolute emergency. Their belief is that they're not supposed to take interest in their appearance because it promotes vanity. So they dress in dark colors. The women wear longer dresses. It's considered vain to wear a button on your dress as a woman, to have buttons.
God, so basically they're a huge fucking bummer. And you know what's great about when we do Amish stories is that they can't listen and tell us what we got wrong.
They'll never fucking know a word we're saying about those phony bitches.
No, those phony fucking button bitches.
They're so phony. It's calling the Amish phony.
Phony phonies.
Fucking phonies. Okay. No, they're actually the realist.
Okay.
So... they also don't allow the teenagers, Amish teenagers go to get to do their Rumspringa, where they go out into the world for a year and party and go crazy. And then they get to come back and then they're like, yeah, this is better. And it is better. They have homemade butter and those barns.
Yeah.
And those wood burning stoves that they sell on TV. So the Schwarzentruber Amish teenagers do not get to leave, but they do allow them to quote court in order to find a marriage partner, which includes hugging in a bed while being fully clothed and rocking in a chair together. So
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. You see him across the room and you're like, oh my God, what is this electricity that I'm feeling?
Yeah, because I don't know what electricity is.
Because
I don't know what this means.
Come on.
You're trying to high five me from across the
room. I just held up my hand to high five Georgia, and she fucking picked up her foot and pointed it at me like I was gonna high five her foot. That was genius.
That was too far away.
That was genius. Okay. This is a good start. So, that was so something my sister would do. Okay, so, yeah, so it's hardcore. And there's a young woman named Ida who is raised, she's in the community. Her family is well liked. She's, a pretty young girl that everybody likes. And they show this thing in the episode of this show where one of the ways that the boys and girls, teenage boys and girls mix together is they go sing in groups in a barn.
Sounds like a fucking blast.
Right? They go into the barn. The guys are kind of over on one side singing and then the girls are on their side singing. So Ida goes to one of these mixers. That's a generous way to describe it. And there she meets a fellow Schwartz and Truber Amishman named Eli Stutzman. He's good looking, he's witty, he's sophisticated, he's charismatic, he was a rebel. The people in this
he
episode
wore a button.
He wore a button. He fucking had a button like as a pin.
Right, rebel.
No, he didn't just use it as a button. It wasn't. He just had an extra fucking button. Yeah.
Superfluous button.
Oh my God, are you the Fonz? So the people in this episode, there was this really awesome woman who used to be Amish, and she had the greatest accent, and she was like so like, you know, wearing her white turtleneck.
Proper, yeah.
Yeah, very, but the craziest accent. You mm-hmm. couldn't figure out what that accent was. And she was saying that he always stood out, that he was this, you know, he was really good looking, and he just kind of was like this thing everyone paid attention to because he was just different than the other Amish teenage boys.
He was the Fabio of the Amish world.
Totally.
Okay.
The actor that they got to play him in the reenactments looked like the main guy from Walking Dead.
Oh.
So he had
cheekbones.
Cheekbones and kind of like rangy, you know, like something's going on with
yeah.
that guy.
Yeah.
He might shoot you and eat you. So his father was a bishop.
Okay.
And he was like a rebel. So he was his father, and he fought constantly, really viciously, because he would talk in church. He was always just doing something. He did whatever he wanted, and made the father crazy and embarrassed. And he couldn't control him. Mm-hmm. And he was always testing the limits, they said. So, of course, Ida immediately is like, I'm in love with this
love
guy.
Him.
He's
love
incredible.
Him. He won't stop talking during church. Love him.
He's a fucking fighter.
He don't shut his fucking mouth at church.
He's whispering during the Bible reading. Okay, so she ends up, her parents are worried that she's mixing in with the, you know, a bad Amish. But other people say that she had this calming effect on him, and that he was much less rebellious, and they were clearly really into each other and in love. Mm-hmm. And the way they describe it, the Amish describe it, is when you have these things, they call it being worldly. So like if you're really into your appearance in the vanity thing, that's mm-hmm. a worldly issue. Mm-hmm. It means like you're from outside world.
Yeah.
So his worldly ways created problems in the community and with his father specifically. And so he gets in such a bad fight with his father, he leaves the community. Mm-hmm. And of course, Ida's devastated. He never says a word to her. He just leaves. She's brokenhearted, but she knows they're in love. She believes they're in love, and she believes he's going to come back. so he goes and stays at a different farm, another Amish family. He goes and stays there, like rents a room. Mm-hmm. But he ends up getting kicked out because the mother in the family finds gay porn in his room.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Fucking 180.
So she's in the reenactment. She's making this bed with the big, beautiful Amish quilt on it. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, what's this over here? And basically, this was a thing that he had been dealing with as part of his rebellion and part of his thing.
Do you think the Amish woman was just like, what is this? And she's like, I'm going to take 5 minutes and then I'm going to go tell everyone.
She's like, I better look through this to make sure.
Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah.
Go on.
So you can imagine how freaked out they were, where they were like, they just immediately kick him out of
the
house.
Where did he even find gay porn?
Well, it sounds like he was kind of, from the looks of it and the sound of it, he was a bit of a sociopath. So he got what he wanted all the time.
So he went to a Buc-ee's and he was like,
down to the Buc-ee's. He put on his worldly suspenders so that nobody would, you know, pick up on him.
Okay, so
he ends up moving back into the community, and he tells Ida that he wants to marry her and start a life, and he's going to reform and he's going to be good, mm-hmm. which essentially was he had nowhere else to go. Mm-hmm. And so he comes back, he apologizes, he repents. They get married on Christmas 1975. So after a month, she's pregnant. And they start their family. You know, their son Danny is born, obviously, 9 months later. turns out the Amish carry their children for 9 months, just like the worldly folk.
Wow.
So They move, their son Danny's born, and then they move to a farm and they start a dairy business. So they have a bunch of cows, they milk the cows, they sell the milk, and that's how they make their money. Mm-hmm. And they all work on this farm. It's really hard work, but they're actually doing okay. And Ida gets pregnant for a second time. And then one night, an electrical storm hits. And they wake up in the middle of the night and a lightning bolt has hit the barn and it's caught it on fire. So they run outside and Ida runs straight into the barn. She's like, I'm going to go save those pails of milk.
What?
And, yes.
Girl.
And he runs to go to the pump to get to start filling buckets with water. Mm-hmm. And when he comes back with the buckets of water, Ida is laying in the doorway of the barn unconscious. And so they call, he, you know, gets neighbors, they end up calling 911. When the police and the fire department, everybody get there, he explains that Ida, when she was a child, she had a bout of rheumatic fever. And so she had a weak heart. Mm-hmm. And she ended up being dead. And so they were like, oh, she must have been so scared of this mm-hmm. fire and having run in and everything that she just had a heart attack and died. So they list her death as cardiac arrest.
Wow.
So he of course, is completely grief-stricken, and the community rallies around him. They all start working at the farm to make sure the dairy farm keeps going. Mm-hmm. He's just in the house. Some people come to take care of Danny because mm-hmm. he's just like completely beside himself. And Ida's mother actually moves in to take care of Danny. And slowly, as the months go by, she notices Eli is less and less grief-stricken and more acting like the rebel that he was before he left the first time. And within months of her death, he has the whole farm electrified.
What?
Yeah, so there's a really hilarious scene where they just walk in and he's got this big, really devious smile on his face. He like reaches up and pulls at the string and like the light goes on in the kitchen. Like, yes,
see,
this is mine. So he puts in lights everywhere. He buys a car. He cuts his hair and he starts leaving the house at night. Mm-mm. So Ida's mother's like, what the fuck is going on? Mm-hmm. So then it turns out he put an ad in the personal section of a gay newspaper.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So he was going to live that secret dream uh-huh. that he wanted to do before. Uh-huh. And here, this is how the ad read.
Oh, dear.
Amish man, muscular, 30s, 5'7", 140, blue eyes, brown hair, straight appearing, I think is what that's, STRAPP, right?
Very strapping appearance?
What?
Strapping?
Strapping.
What is it?
I was thinking they meant like straight. Like he seems straight.
Okay, got it.
But it could be strapping appearance.
Probably not.
The brawny man. Very discreet, affectionate, health conscious, sense of humor, would like to meet others into farming, ranching, or carpentry for friendship or possible relationship. Mm-mm. So he's going for it.
I mean, find love, dude.
I love farming and ranching are very similar. I'm not sure why he used up those letters to write both, but maybe there's a subtle difference. I'm not sure. Or it could be code. I don't know. So he starts having parties in the barn and like
where
men are coming.
Wife died.
Yes. Men are, you know, this is months after, right, but right. Men are coming to the ranch. Gay men. And it says, It says here, he starts having parties in the barn for gay, English, and Amish men. So I think it's just like whoever wants to come. But basically, the entire community starts gossiping because they're just like, did you hear?
And he's not being discreet.
In the he's got lights on, like for starters. So finally, there's so much gossip, and he goes and tells the family friends, like, he's so hurt by all this gossip, making it seem like it's all malicious and untrue, mm-hmm. that he, in 1982, he sells the farm, he takes Danny, and he leaves. And he settles in Austin, Texas. And it was really hard for Danny to make that adjustment because he went from being you know, old school Amish into just the real world of Austin, Texas. So he became really withdrawn. He had a really hard time. Meanwhile, his dad was basically opens a construction business and just starts freely dating gay men, like dating openly in a very modern way. Which, you know, it's the early 80s in Texas. Like it must have been dangerous to say the least.
Totally.
In the fall of 1984, Eli is driving down the road and he sees a hitchhiker. He picks him up and his name's Glenn Pritchard. And Glenn Pritchard is a divorced father of two who used to be Mormon and had a really bad drinking problem. He left the Mormon church. He left his family, or, you know, maybe his wife divorced him because of his drinking problem. He tried to join the Coast Guard to solve the problem. He got kicked out. So now he's just kind of lost. So Eli offers him a job at the construction business and room and board in the house. So he actually, Danny, Eli's son, gets along with Glenn really well. And Glenn has two kids and he really misses his kids. Aww. And so he, you know, takes Danny on as like his own and looks out for him. And he really doesn't like the way Eli's bringing men home constantly and is in no way tries to hide it. And Glenn's really uncomfortable, like that he's doing it in front of Danny and thinks, you know, and tries to talk to him about it. But he doesn't. He, you know, Eli has none of that. And then he's like, well, I also have another problem, which is you haven't paid me in 6 months. Because he's been working, you know, for the construction company and, and Eli's not paying. And Eli's like, I have a cash flow problem. I'm going to get you the money. He's like, well, you need to get me the money. Well, it turns out they find Glenn Pritchard dead in a ditch. He's been shot. And when the police come to talk to Eli, they find his last place of residence. Eli says, I haven't seen him in 2 months. I don't know what happened to him. Immediately, police are like, there's something going on with this guy. When they go back to question him a second time, like a week later, Danny and Eli have left town. So basically, Eli drops Danny off at a family that he met when he kind of first left Ohio, where they started out. There's like a family named the Barlows in Wyoming that he met. They, I don't think he knew them that well. And he brings Danny to their house and drops him off and is basically, can you take care of him? I have to go, and like makes up some reason why some business he has to go take care of. And he's like, I'll be back. And 6 months later, he calls and says he's coming to get Danny to take him to Danny's grandparents for Christmas. So he's going to take him to Ida's parents.
Oh, my God.
Back to Amish country. Danny's thrilled. Then the grandparents are also thrilled because they hear that they're coming back for the holidays. And so they haven't seen Danny in 5 years.
Oh, my God.
So they're thrilled that they get to see him again and reconnect. 10 days later, it's Christmas Eve. They don't show up.
Oh, no.
So, of course, the family's really worried. Eventually, they get a letter from Eli saying he's skiing with friends in Idaho. He keeps sending letters, just giving them updates on what they're doing out in the world. And sometimes Danny sends letters, too, just saying, you know, I'm learning this in school and blah, blah, blah. So then the grandparents in July, so it's like, you know, 6 months after they didn't show up for Christmas, they get a letter saying that Danny was killed in a car accident and buried in Wyoming on the family plot of the Barlows, the family that he stayed with.
Oh, my God.
And the grandparents were like, well, we want to see. Tell us more about it. Yeah. And he just doesn't say anything else. So they end up getting on a bus. These old school Amish people who are not allowed to ride in cars. They break the rule. They get on a bus and they go to Wyoming so that they can go see their grandson's grave. So when they get there, their last name is Gingrich. Uh-huh. So they get, the Gingriches get to the Barlows in Wyoming, and they say, will you please show us our grandson's grave? And they don't know what they're talking about.
No.
And they're like, the last that we heard is they left, you know, Eli came and picked them up, and they were going driving around, and we haven't heard anything else. He's not buried here. So then they have to ride back on the bus. Like, now they have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. On December 24th, 1985, in Chester, Nebraska, a hunter is walking through a field.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh. And he sees something across the field, and it's fucking cold. You know, it's Nebraska in December. He thinks it's a mannequin. He thinks it's a doll. And when he comes up on it, it's the body of a young boy in blue pajamas, laying on his back with his hand over his heart. Mm. And it's so cold outside that the skin is blue. And he's dead. And authorities can't identify him. There's nothing identifying on him. So they end up calling him Little Boy Blue. And 2 years later, Reader's Digest does a story about Little Boy Blue and the hunter who found them, and how there was no sign of trauma on the body. They don't know how he died, and the authorities hadn't figured out a cause of death. They just know he was wearing blue pajamas. So the Barlows find this story in Reader's Digest magazine.
No.
They know that when Danny left their house, when Eli came to pick him up, he was wearing blue pajamas.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah. So they have a bad feeling, and they go to police, or they call police, and the police come over, and the investigator who was on the scene when the body was found is the one that goes to the Barlow's house, and they go pull out a picture of Danny, and he immediately knows that's the boy. And they end up taking some of the things that Danny left behind at the Barlow's house, one of which was a copy of the Velveteen Rabbit book, which was his favorite book.
Aww.
And they fingerprint off of the pages of that book, and they identify it. Okay. And it was his body.
Oy.
It's so sad. So on December 14th, it's identified as Danny Stutzman. And they realize Eli has been sending letters from Danny to the grandparents 7 months after Danny was actually dead in that field.
So he died immediately after leaving the Barlow's house, probably because he was
pretty
in
much
pajamas.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Then in, I think it's Hazel, Texas, but it may have been something like Easel, Texas, but I couldn't figure out what the narrator was saying. But basically, in a Texas town, I believe it was outside Fort Worth, Eli files a police report because his car gets stolen, and immediately the police go and arrest him, and he's extradited to Wyoming.
Uh-huh.
So when he gets there, he tells the police that he picked Danny up from the Barlow's, and he was sick when he picked him up. And they were driving all night, and Eli just assumed that he was sleeping. And then at one point, he checked on him because he wasn't responsive, and he figured out that he was dead. So he took Danny's body and laid it out in a field, quote, where God could find him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So upon learning this and that bullshit story, the police reopen Ida's death from 1977, and they go talk to Ida's doctor, who is in this special, and he is like this, I'm assuming he's an Amish doctor, because he looks like a character actor from Little House on the Prairie, and he kind of talks like this. He's very quiet. And basically the police went to them, and they were asking him about Ida's heart problem, and he's like, what are you talking about? She didn't have a heart problem.
Uh-oh.
And they're like, what? And he goes, where did you get that? And they were like, the husband. And he's like, no, she was in perfect health. So then they know basically that he had something to do with that death, but they have no evidence to connect him to it whatsoever. When the Austin police ask him about Glenn Pritchard's death, though, he changes his story from what the original story was.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells them that he was in the house with Danny. They heard a gunshot go off, but he didn't get up and check to see what the noise was.
Sure.
And then, how you would do if you were in a house and someone else got shot. And then the next morning when he got up to check, Glenn was gone. And so he didn't know what happened and never looked into it.
Uh-huh.
So turns out when the police go to talk to the neighbors are like, we could hear them screaming about money at each other constantly. And we heard the gunshot.
Oh my God.
So they, that like the neighbors tell a totally different story. And so basically the theory becomes Danny was there when his father shot Glenn Pritchard and he didn't want the witness. So he smothered Danny. And that's why there was no signs of trauma on the body.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And then left his body in a fucking field, which is just the weird, like that alone, the idea that he thought he was going to be able to tell authorities that like left him where God could find him, where it's like
you thought that was okay somehow, or it's like, no one would think that was okay.
You would never do that to your child.
No,
it doesn't even make sense.
No.
Anyway, in August of 1989, he's sentenced to 40 years in prison. But he's paroled in March of 2002.
He
ended up serving like a quarter of his term.
Stop it, everyone.
But when he gets out, he moves to Fort Worth. He lives a super low-key life because he found out while he was in prison that he had HIV.
Oh my God.
So he ends up on January 31st, 2007, he committed suicide. He slashed his wrist, sat down in a chair, and then watched TV until he bled out and died.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And that, Eli Stutzman, is the Amish serial killer. So it's not serial in the way that we would love it to be.
Well, we don't love it.
No, not love it, but like, I'm thinking Buffalo Bill when I start this story, but then it is the thing of this is a sociopath slash psychopath who just would kill anybody that got in the way of what he wanted to do in his life. And the idea that that's coming out of, it's just like, it just fascinates me. It could be, it doesn't matter how you grew up.
Right.
It doesn't matter where you came from. If you have that thing in your brain that makes you only want to like win and like dominate people, and it doesn't matter
if you're like immune to fucking empathy.
Yep,
you're immune to it.
Yeah, you don't give a shit.
That's crazy.
You just do what you want.
Ugh. And then you leave so many people in your wake, you know, the grandparents of
horrifying
these people,
all of it,
and you just don't fucking care.
And that, again, just so everyone knows, Deadly Devotion, that was that, basically, I just told you that episode of Deadly Devotion, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
I love that. Never heard of it. Incredible. Not just the show, but like the...
The concept?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant, like perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Kraft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient, because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all Made In, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com.
Goodbye. Okay.
Beep boop.
All right. Listen, like when I said that this is a closer, I didn't mean it was like a lighthearted story. So I'm not happy about it, but there's no gruesome details in it.
I mean, I feel like if we ever sat down and did like a scientific pie graph or something, it would be like the one you can't get out of is dead children.
Right.
Murdered children is the hardest.
Right. Okay. Well, then this is a little bit. All right. Let me just do this. Okay.
Okay.
In honor of what we talked about last week of like websites like Ranker and all these of like the lists that they do.
Yes.
This is three super mysterious disappearances.
Okay.
All right.
Yes.
Let's do it. I'm changing the rules.
I love
doing
it.
This.
Now okay. You can do whatever you want.
I'm starting with the Springfield Three.
Mm.
You know them?
Mm-mm.
Okay. This is just weird to me because there's not. Let's read about it.
Okay.
The Springfield Three story begins June 7th, 1992. Two friends, Susie Streeter, she's 19, and Stacy McCall, she's 18. So picture the bangs and the fucking bleach blonde hair. The two girls graduated from Kickapoo High School the day before, and so they're celebrating like graduation of that sort of thing.
Yep.
So they are seen around 2 a.m. on June 7th, leaving the last of the graduation parties they had attended that evening. They were supposed to spend the night at a friend's house, but when they got to the friend's house, it was too crowded, probably with people sleeping and not sleeping. So they were like, fuck it, we're going back to Susie's house. And at Susie's house was Susie's mom, Cheryl Levitt. She's 47. She's a cosmetologist at a local salon. She's a single mother, and she's really close with her daughter. So they go back to her house. The next morning, around 9 a.m., a friend and her boyfriend go to the house to pick up, because the two girls were supposed to have picked them up to go to like a water park for the graduation activities, blah, blah, blah. When they get there, they find the front door unlocked, and they go in the house, but there's no sign of any of the three women. Each of their cars are parked outside, and all their personal property is left behind, including their purses, money, keys, cigarettes, as well as the family dog, who's super agitated and locked in the bathroom.
What?
So they're like, what the fuck? The only weird thing at the scene is that the glass lampshade of the porch light had been shattered, but the bulb inside had been left intact. So the boyfriend sweeps the broken glass up to be helpful. While they're inside, they also answer a strange and disturbing call from an unidentified male who made sexual innuendos.
To who answered the phone?
The girl of the couple.
Oh, okay.
Was there. Yeah, so they went to check on them. The girl answers the phone.
So immediately a dirty phone call.
A dirty phone call immediately. She hangs up, and then another call immediately comes in, again of sexual nature, and she hangs up again. Let's see. So they, okay. Okay. The mother of the girl, Stacy, who didn't live at the house, she later goes to visit the house to be like, where's the fuck is my daughter? I can't get a hold of her. And she inside notices all three of the purses are there, of course, sees her daughter's clothing neatly folded from the night before. She calls the police, and after placing the call, while checking the phone's answering machine, she finds a strange message left. But somehow it was inadvertently erased, the message. So we don't know what the message is.
What?
And what it could have meant.
And did she say what? She just said it was a weird message.
I think it was like another sexual nature message. So police were very interested in the call and believed it may have been contained a clue, but it's fucking gone.
Just gone forever?
Gone forever.
Because this is early 90s, like, was it still like a answering machine with tape in it?
Yeah, I think so, right? We just you rewind it.
Yeah.
And record over it.
They still existed then.
Yeah.
Although there was you know, that, well, in our household anyway, we got the like call, the answering machine became, it was just in your phone. And
right.
You just basically got ordered what you wanted.
Right.
Like, it would take messages, but then you could also get, that's when Star 69
right.
made its grand debut.
Well, I remember when we had that like silver and black fucking message machine with a tiny cassette inside.
Yeah.
And you would listen to a message and then you rewound the tape.
Yep.
And recorded over it, and then you could get new messages, but you could only get as many messages as could be left on that little cassette. I fucking love that machine. I thought it was fascinating.
It is amazing. Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Okay. So the police aren't called for 16 hours after the women were last seen at 2 a.m. the night before.
Okay.
and other worried friends and family called and visited a home that day, which means a fucking shit ton of people walked through the house during the day. 10 to 20 people walked through the house. Upon arrival, the officers noticed no signs of a struggle except for the shattered porch light. And they also noted that the beds had been slept in. So
had been.
Ew. So in 1997, Levitt and Streeter are declared legally dead, but their case files are still officially listed under missing. Investigators received a tip that the women's bodies were buried in the foundations of the south parking garage at Cox Hospital. Whoa. So in 2007, crime reporter Kathy Bayard brought a man named Rick Norland, a mechanical engineer, to Springfield to scan the corner of the parking lot with ground penetrating radar.
Ooh.
He found three anomalies roughly the same size, quote, that he said were consistent with a grave site location in the foundation.
Oh, fuck.
Two of the anomalies were parallel and the other was perpendicular. So kind of crosshatched. The Springfield Police Department didn't believe the scan was conclusive enough to justify tearing up the concrete, and also said that the parking garage was completed a year after the women's disappearance.
Hmm.
But they could have been left somewhere.
Right.
So it was never tore up, but people think it's there. Then Reddit's also like, here's how you're fucking wrong. It's not.
Oh,
you know.
Okay.
So then in 1997, Robert Craig Cox, he's imprisoned in Texas as a convicted kidnapper and robber and the suspect in a Florida murder. He told journalists that he knew where the three women had been murdered and buried and claimed their bodies would never be found. He, in 1992, at the time, he had been living in Springfield, but had alibis for the night. But it was like his girlfriend at the time who has since been like, nobody was fucking lying about it.
Yeah.
He said that he would disclose to what happened to the three women after his mother had died, but he knew what happened. And as of today, a couple tips a month still come in, but no one knows what happened to this Springfield three.
Oh my god!
Yeah, these three fucking women.
And that guy's mother hasn't died.
I guess not.
But he's
but everyone
in jail?
Thinks he. But everyone also thinks he's lying.
Oh, he's just trying to get some kind of
but a kidnapper from that neighborhood, you know.
Yeah,
it's just crazy.
That's super crazy.
Yeah. Okay, so the next one is a girl named Aisha Degree. Aisha is born August 5th, 1990. She's a fucking normal 9-year-old fourth grader from Shelby, North Carolina. Normal girl, happy family, etc. The night of February 14th, 2000, Aisha and her brother went to sleep as usual in the room they shared, her older brother. Almost an hour later, the power went out in the neighborhood after a nearby car accident, which is fucking creepy and weird, but isn't connected to this. But I think it's just creepy.
Yeah.
It's restored, and then after that, her dad, Harold, returns home from work around 12:30 in the morning. He checks on his daughter and son, just saw them both sleeping, normal. But shortly after he went to bed, around 2:30 a.m., he recalls hearing Aisha's bed squeak. At that point, allegedly, Aisha got out of bed, took a book bag she had previously packed with several sets of clothes and personal items, and left the house.
Mm-hmm. She's I've heard of this.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy.
She's 9 years old.
Yes.
Leaves. Between 3:45 a.m. and 4:15 a.m., two drivers saw her walking south along Highway 18 wearing a long sleeve white t-shirt and white pants. And one witness reported seeing her at about 4 a.m. and said that he turned his car around because he thought it was strange that such a small child would be out by herself at that hour. But when he circled three times, he saw her run into the woods by the roadside and disappear.
Ugh, it's just bone chilling.
I know.
To think you're driving home. You went to a party. You're like, I want to leave. I don't want to be at this party. Yeah. People are like, please just stay two more hours. Blah, blah, blah.
Suddenly 4 a.m. is around. You're
it's
like,
4 a.m.
I'm leaving.
As you're driving home, you're like, sober, bummed, wanted to go home 3 hours ago. This is how I picture everything in my life. And then you're driving down a highway and see a child dressed in all white walking with a book bag.
Yeah.
I and would you never go, stop screaming.
And then you go back. You're like, what the fuck? This is weird. You go back and you go to drive by her again. And she runs into the fucking woods.
She fucking darts away.
What do you do?
call the police. You yes. call the police site, right? You pull your car over, you leave it there. Yeah. You call the police.
And you but you don't have cell phones yet.
Girl. Oh, right.
Shit. Yeah. No cell phones yet. Maybe he went home and called.
Maybe. Yeah. What? Why wasn't he a rich guy with one of those crazy huge cell phones in his car? Rich guys.
Because this isn't fucking Dallas or whatever TV show they had those in. Okay. Okay. And so there was, okay, it was a rainy night too. Add that to this motherfucking thing. A rainy night. And the witness said there was a storm raging when he saw her.
No.
Yeah.
There's no way I wouldn't think that was a ghost if I saw it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because it's so insane.
Yeah. At 6:30 a.m. that morning, Aisha's mother went into the kids' room to wake them up. She found Aisha gone. And she called the police, who arrived by 6:40 a.m. Police dogs are called to the scene. They could not pick up Aisha's scent. So February 17th, 2 days after the search began, candy wrappers are found in a shed in a nearby business along the highway near where Aisha had been seen running into the woods. So candy wrappers.
Okay.
Along with them were a pencil, a marker, and a Mickey Mouse-shaped hair bow that were identified as belonging to her. So it's almost like she ran away at this point, it seems.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But why would a kid run away in a raging storm? That doesn't seem normal.
Yeah, I bet it started raining when she was right. got outside.
Right.
I would think.
Right.
Because any plan you would have if it was raining, you'd be like, I'll do this tomorrow. Yeah,
for sure. Okay, a week later, after no other traces or witnesses were found, the search was called off. FBI got involved and noted she was not a typical runaway, obviously. She was under 12, didn't have normal stuff such as a dysfunctional family. She didn't have bad grades. And by all accounts, she was a shy, sweet girl with close family, church community, all this shit. She didn't even have a computer in the house. So the thing of like her running away to meet someone she met online.
Oh, that's not.
That doesn't make any sense. I mean, doesn't make sense, right?
Right.
There was no blood, no signs of a struggle or a car accident. And for 18 months, everything stalled until Aisha's book bag was found during a construction project. So the backpack with her name and telephone number written inside was found wrapped in a plastic trash bag about 26 miles from her home. It was said that the bag looks carefully prepared as if she were instructed by an adult what to pack.
No.
In May 2016, the FBI announced that their reinvestigation of the case had turned up a new witness that had come forward and reported seeing a girl who resembled Aisha getting into a dark green 1970s Lincoln Mark IV or Ford Thunderbird with rust around the wheel near where she was last seen. So a scholarship in her name is created for deserving local students, and family members hold an annual march each February retracing what they believe is the path that she took the night she vanished. But they don't know why. And the thing about the path she took too is that it's the path that her school bus took in the morning. It's not, or like when she went to school, it's not an easily walkable path. It's almost like it was the only way she knew how to get from certain points in town because yes. she took it every day.
Yeah.
Rather than that was her purposeful, planned
like path. She knows if she's going to go to, say, the town library.
Right.
This is the way she's going to get to the library.
The way you go. Yeah.
Oh.
It's just this weird story.
That is maddening because
yeah.
it's like who got into her ear
yeah.
and was like, do you want to audition for TV?
Right.
Do you
and how come to? She didn't tell any of her friends like, oh, I met this person,
or her parents like, oh my God.
Yeah.
That's maddening. And yeah. how long ago did it happen?
It happened in 2000.
Man.
Yeah.
And she's nine. I it's
know.
So much younger than.
Yeah.
That's like. That makes me think it's like someone who's like made her believe something
mm-hmm.
that she could have something that she normally couldn't have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if you meet me here, I'm giving away this pony type
right.
of shit.
Right.
Ugh, fuck.
It's really. And then like all of that up until that point is like, okay, she ran away from home for a certain reason. Everything would have been normal. But then when they find her backpack buried wrapped in plastic, something, she ran into someone or something.
Someone. And the things in the backpack.
Yeah.
If somebody, like, that idea that she packed it specifically for a reason and it was a plan.
Yeah.
God damn.
Fucked up.
Horrifying.
All right. The last one has a resolution.
Okay.
Okay. Bobby Dunbar. Ready for this?
Yes.
Okay. Bobby Dunbar was the firstborn son to Leslie and Percy Dunbar of Opeliawi.
Hawaii?
No. To a town in Louisiana.
Okay.
Opelousas. Nope. Louisiana. In August 1912.
I think Lucinda, I could be wrong, but Lucinda Williams has a song. It's.
Say it.
I think it's Opelousas.
That must be it.
Or am I thinking of Nacogdoches? Yeah, forget it.
The song might be about Bobby Dunbar.
Yeah.
Okay. In August of 1912.
Oh.
Yeah. The Dunbars took a fishing trip to nearby Swayze Lake in St. Landry Parish, Louisiana. While on that trip, little Bobby Dunbar disappears. After an 8-month search, authorities found a handyman traveling through Mississippi with a boy. And it's like this crazy search with his photo everywhere. It's this missing child, blah, 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 who appeared to match the description of Bobby Dunbar. The man with him, William Cantwell Walters, he claims that the boy was actually named Charles Bruce Anderson, and he was the son of a woman who worked for his family. And that the boy's mother, named Julia Anderson, she had willingly granted him in custody of this boy. And doesn't matter, fucking Walters is arrested, and authorities sent for the Dunbars to come to Mississippi and identify this boy that they think is their son.
Oh, okay.
That they think is his son. They think it's Bobby Dunbar.
Do you know how much longer it was after he disappeared?
It was 8 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So pretty quickly. Upon seeing the missing son, her missing son, there's like, there's differing reports. Some say that the mother, Leslie, like freaked out and was like, my son, and Bobby Dunbar was like, mom, you know, and they embraced. And other people said that, that the boy cried and said that, and agreed that this wasn't, that his mother, you know, was someone else.
Yeah. How could those, how could there be two different exact opposite stories?
Yeah.
Like, didn't it happen in a police station?
Yeah,
you'd
but...
You'd think there'd be an official...
Yeah, but media, man, they like to...
True.
Not that they're not talking shit on media.
Everyone's great.
Vital, etc.
Now more than ever.
So, yeah. So they're like, all right, maybe this is our kid. Let's bring him home tonight and see how it goes.
This is just like The Changeling.
It's just like The Changeling.
Fuck.
In real fucking life.
It happened like 30 years before.
Yeah.
Fuck. Okay.
Can you imagine? I mean, I guess at the time you don't have photos or something, but not knowing if this person is your kid or not. How does that happen?
I don't know. Well, but in The Changeling, she knew it wasn't her kid, and it was the cops going, no, crazy bitch, this is your kid.
Right. And it's also like a grief-stricken mother who's like, this resembles my kid. I really want it to be my kid. They're telling me it's my kid. Maybe they're right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, your worst fear is that your child is gone forever, so... Anybody showing up and being like, it's me, you know.
Yeah. But he was, the kid wasn't even like, according to certain stories, the kid was like, no, this isn't who I am. This is not my parent.
Also, you have to think of this kid that was just being driven around randomly by some dude.
Yeah.
What was happening to him?
Yeah.
And what kind of state of shock and freak out was he in? It's almost like you combine two people who are in shock and trauma together.
Totally.
Ugh, okay.
And it's like, okay. So, yeah, you're not going to say to, okay, the police officers, the mother's not going to be like, no, you guys are wrong. This isn't, you know, you're not going to do that.
No, I fucking, how many bad haircuts have I gotten where as it's happening, I'm like, well, you're the boss.
Yeah, looks great.
I guess I don't know what I like anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. So they're like, we don't know if it's him. We bring him home tonight. We give him a bath. And then the next day, they're like, yep, that's our kid. Based on moles and scars, they're like, it's totally our son.
Okay.
All is well. So the boy goes home with the Dunbars. There's a fucking parade and fanfare celebrating the homecoming. Everyone's like, we found the missing Dunbar boy. And then shortly after, Julia Anderson, the mother of the boy who originally was supposed to be, that wasn't Bobby Dunbar, she's in North Carolina. She arrives and, you know, is like, that's actually my kid. And I didn't tell him he could take him for that long. But she goes to she's unmarried and worked as a field hand for the family of the man who had him. She said that she allowed him to take her son for what said was supposed to be a 2-day trip to visit one of Walter's relatives, and that she had not consented for him to take him for more than a few days.
Okay.
Yeah. So this woman, Julia, is presented with 5 different boys, basically a fucking boy photo lineup.
Yeah.
And the same age as her son, including the boy who had been claimed by the Dunbars. And the boy is presented. He gave no indication that he recognized this woman as his mother.
Oh.
Yeah. And she asked whether he was the boy recovered. She's like, is that the boy you found? Like, didn't totally recognize him at first either.
Also, what do you give a shit? Aren't you looking for your son? Why are you asking other questions?
Yeah.
Name
your son. She didn't know for sure. She was like, is that?
How do you? Okay.
Yes.
Right?
She said she was unsure at the end of it. And I'm wondering, so this kid who's now or isn't the Bobby Dunbar boy, like, goes home with this family. They have a fucking, maybe a nice house and all this nice shit. And he sees his mother trying to get him back, who's a fucking field hand.
Yep.
And he doesn't say anything, maybe.
Yeah.
You know?
He's like,
as sad as that is.
Well, and also, she's the one that put him in that car with that man.
Yeah. He thought she didn't want her anymore, maybe, and was just like, huh.
Yeah.
I'm not going back to this shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yay.
But she takes the boy back with her and sees him the next day. I guess in the station, she undresses him. So this fucking kid is getting undressed left and fucking right
Jesus
by people.
Christ.
She then indicated a strong certainty that the boy was her son, Bruce, and not Bobby Dunbar.
Okay.
But of course, everyone was already like, fuck you, poor lady, that's not true, you're lying. So of course then the newspapers question her moral character, because she had had 3 children, the other 2 which were deceased by that point, out of wedlock. And so her claims were dismissed.
Oh
yeah. But she does go to the kidnapping trial of this guy Walters and says and repeats that, you know, he didn't kidnap my son. And the court reaches the determination that the boy was Bobby Dunbar conclusively. They were like, period, it's not this other kid Bruce, it's Bobby Dunbar. This guy Walters is convicted of kidnapping, and the boy remains in the custody and grows up with the Dunbar family as Bobby Dunbar, the kid who had gone missing when they went camping.
Yeah.
Okay. So
wait, this does have a resolution?
Yeah.
We're gonna know what happens?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Please God.
Okay.
Because this is nuts. This is like 4 movies combined.
Yeah.
Because it also reminded me of the Wineville chicken coop murders.
Yes.
There's some feel to it too.
That's what.
Oh, it's the same thing as a changeling. That's
the changeling.
Right.
But that chicken coop murder story is insane.
It's so fucked up. But there were kids who, at the end of that, were afraid they were going to get in trouble, so they denied that they belonged to the parents that were there to claim them. I'm thinking of those two things as 2 separate things, but it was basically just the end of the story where they were like, nope, that's not me, because they thought they were going to get, like, spanked.
Yeah.
Like, it's that crazy little kid mentality.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's so sad. Okay, so this boy is raised as Bobby Dunbar, whether or not it's him, for sure. He marries, has 4 children of his own, and dies in 1966, having lived out the remainder of his life as Bobby Dunbar.
Wow.
This guy. Okay, years after his death, one of his granddaughters, Margaret Dunbar Cutright, begins her own investigation of the events, because I think it was like a family fucking story that nobody wanted to talk about. So she pours through newspaper accounts, interviews the children of Julia Anderson, the woman who claimed that kid was hers, and they actually said to her, you know, this man came and visited us, and I think it was him. Trying to see, like, the kid who was raised as Bobby Dunbar as an adult came back to the town where they lived to meet his maybe siblings.
Oh.
and examine the notes and evidence presented at Walter's defense, presented by Walter's defense attorney for his kidnapping trial and appeal. In 2004, after an Associated Press reporter approached the family about the story, Bobby Dunbar Jr. consented to undergo a DNA test to resolve the issue. The test showed that the kid raised as Bobby Dunbar was 100% not related to the Dunbars.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So that poor fucking woman that came down is like, this is my son. He got taken away from me. Yeah. They were like, too late. We already did the parade.
It's this.
It's a permanent.
The ticker tape has been tickered.
Once we ticker that tape, it's over, lady. We can't go back.
It's just this whole thing, too. You've got to wonder, like, did the parents of Bobby Dunbar know in their heart and were okay because they just couldn't come to terms with the fact that maybe their son was dead? Did Julia Anderson, was she like, this kid has a better life now. I'm fucking pissed, but.
But I'm not going to fight that hard because he's not, these are good people.
He's being raised. Yeah. Who knows? Well, okay. So apparently Julia would speak of her lost son, Bruce, a lot, and that the family always regarded him as having been kidnapped by the Dunbars. So they never got over
shit.
It. Okay. But there is an incredible This American Life about this case. Ooh. Called The Ghost of Bobby Dunbar. That it's, I think it's from like 2004. I remember listening to it and just, I was like painting my bedroom one weekend and then had to sit down in the middle of the room just to fucking listen to it because it was so powerful.
Shit.
So it's an incredible episode. You should definitely listen to it. And in it, Margaret Dunbar Cutright, they interview her through it. She expresses the opinion that the real Bobby Dunbar, the kid who went fucking camping at Swayze Lake, that he was probably eaten by an alligator back in 1912. That's what she thinks happened.
Whoa.
It kind of also reminds me of the Someone Knows Something season one, where it's like, did this kid drown or did something happen to him?
Yes.
It's that sort of thing too, where it's like, he disappeared. Did he get kidnapped? Did he die? But she thinks that he probably drowned or was,
because it's
that
thing of like, out in nature, it could be anything. You can't even figure out, like, anything could happen. And like that idea of just an alligator going boop and that being it, like, that happens often.
It's fucking Louisiana, like,
yeah,
those alligators are up in there.
I can't believe, see, this makes, now I'm upset, because when you look up the Wineville Chicken Coop murders or watch the movie The Changeling, there should be some, if you like this, read about this.
Yeah.
Because that's like so fascinating.
Yeah. Old timey kidnappings and missing people fucking fascinate me.
Because there was like no DNA, no phones.
Barely any photographs even.
Barely forensics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck.
The Ghost of Bobby Dunbar, This American Life.
Amazing. Yeah. Oh, that was great.
So that was three creepy fucking missing people.
Insane.
Stories.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Should we do our favorite thing as what happened at our first show in Dallas?
Yes.
Okay. So why don't you fucking tell everyone?
Okay. Fucking.
Shut up. Is that what I sound like?
No. Please. I do it all the time. No. Okay. So we had a special guest at our Dallas show, and it was really thrilling. Jennifer Maury Caldwell, who we talked about in episode 53. Was it?
I think so, yeah.
51? I think we said it.
51.
Somewhere in the 50s.
Whatever, I just put it. There's a photo of it on Instagram.
It was episode 33.
Essentially, it was the I Survived story that I retold of the woman who lived in the gated apartment community, specifically for the security, ends up waking up in the middle of the night, being attacked, her power is cut, the phone's cut, a guy stabs her, and then the 911 operator stays on the phone with her, and when the security guard comes to ask to be let in, he says, don't let him in, and it ends up that the security guard was the person who attacked her.
Yeah.
And it's the craziest story. She tells it herself. I basically just retold her version of that story as she tells it on I Survived as an episode. We heard from her sometime after, and just saying, hi, I heard, you know, whatever, I heard this.
Which was a huge thing for us. I think, you know, we just didn't expect that. And we've always kind of wondered what impact what we do has on people. And so getting that specifically from the victim of the story was and it was a positive email was so, it felt so good.
Yes, it was really nice. And it was like someone going, I get exactly what you're doing and yeah. I approve. And it happened to me and I approve. So yeah. that in of itself was exciting. Then she lives in Dallas. So she let us know that she tried, I think she tried to get tickets and they were sold out.
She was so sweet. She was like, hey, I tried to get tickets to Dallas, but it's sold out. Do you think maybe? And I was like,
yes, yes. Of course.
So she and her lovely family came to our shows in Dallas. And she, at the end of the show, instead of doing hometowns, we asked her up on stage and the audience went fucking ballistic.
And I started ugly heavy crying.
We all were crying. Yeah. And I think everyone in the audience was crying.
Yes.
And basically we basically want to play this moment for yeah. you. We don't want to wait until whenever it comes up that we're going to play this live episode, because it was just so cool. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. There's probably a lot of long silences because there's definitely moments where we're hugging or just yeah. crying or whatever. But it was just really an honor and a privilege to meet her. She's the coolest woman. She is so chill. She's a lawyer. She's got this beautiful family who all mm-hmm. came with her who were also super cool. And she also told us backstage yeah. the 911 operator from her story. Yeah. It was his first day on the job. It was the second 911 call he had ever taken, and they were lifelong friends. She danced with him at her wedding, like he was the third person yeah. that she danced with at her wedding. You know, it was just the coolest. We got to meet yeah, her and talk
we were
to her.
Honored to be part of this.
So here's that moment.
Now normally this is the part where we do a hometown, but we actually tonight we have a surprise guest for you that we're very, very excited to bring out on stage.
Just a special guest that we want to introduce you guys to. Oh, there's Vince.
And you that's actually, you not there's Vince. It's you might Vince. Remember because we talked about her case on one of our episodes. And she is here in the audience tonight with us. I don't remember the number. Oh, she's walking down right now. She has been in the audience with you this whole time. Her story was on an episode of I Survived. Her name. That's Jennifer Morey Caldwell right there. So when we did this episode, all I did was retell Jennifer's story from her words from an episode of I Survived, because I'm lazy sometimes. I just do, I like to do stuff like that. But also because the story was so incredible and the way she told it was so incredible. It's one of my favorite episodes. Sorry. No. Sorry.
If you told my story so beautifully that the night I heard it, my husband and I drank a whole bottle of wine, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried.
Oh, God.
You honored me when you told my story.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice. Thank you.
Where are thank those God. Damn tissues?
I know. Tammy, thank God.
Is there one for Jennifer?
It's all we have.
Okay.
I
get Stevens. It's in
my nose so on that one. After that episode, you sent us an email, and then we freaked out,
yeah.
And we couldn't believe it, because a lot of times when we do these stories and we do this stuff, we never knew any of this part was going to happen. Like, for a long time, we did this podcast in George's apartment talking to each other. So the idea that the person we're talking about responded and was like, yay, it was just so exciting and so cool. And so then you emailed us and we're like, can I come to a show when you come to Dallas? And we're like, yeah, we can get you in.
Free tickets.
Yeah.
So yeah.
You know, I'm a lawyer, and if you guys know my attack story, my attack's not part of my daily life. I can't let it be. And so I'm sitting in my office one day last September, October, and I had a lawyer say to me, your maiden name's Morey, right? And I'm like, yeah? And she goes, you were attacked, right? And she, I'm like, yeah. And she goes, oh my God, there was this podcast about you last night. Holy shit. And it floored me. And so I went home that night and I told my husband, I think there's this thing. And, and so we like Googled and found this thing. And we sat there and listened to it. And it wasn't something I was really prepared to listen to, but I have to say again. And I listened to it again yesterday to get ready. You talked about me like you were my friend. And I'm gonna cry again. It was a horrible experience, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But God has, I mean, God or whatever, has has blessed me so much. I mean, I've got my husband, Gary, and my two kids are here tonight. So, everybody here, if you ever have anything terrible happen to you, and unfortunately too many of us will have something terrible happen to us, I hope it doesn't happen to you. This show talks a lot about anxiety. I've become a murderino. My daughter is 15, and she probably shouldn't listen to the show, but she does. On road trips, we listen to this. And anyway, if something bad ever happens to anybody out there, I hope you guys have something as, I mean, God, this has just been such a gift to have you honor me and to have people all over the world reach out to me and honor me, so thank you. And what you do, we're all fascinated and horrified by these crimes, but the way you bring laughter to what you could cry or laugh, pick one. Let's laugh.
Yeah.
So thank you, guys.
Yay. Thank you so much. Amazing. Shit.
We are so honored to have you guys.
Amazing.
This means so much to us. Thank you. And thank you guys for being here.
And?
Stay sexy, don't get